Hey, serious privacy enthusiasts. Ready to ace your AI data privacy game?
Oh, you bet, Kay. Dive into the world of TrustArc's Nemity Research, your go-to for staying on top of regulatory developments in AI and privacy.
Seriously, Nemity Research maintains a massive privacy and regulatory database featuring expert guidance and analysis from legal and privacy pros.
So save time on privacy research, cut your compliance timeline, and reduce costs with Nemity Research.
Get your regulatory research and insights at your fingertips with a free trial.
So get ahead in privacy compliance and start that free trial today. Go to trustarc.com/nimity-free-trial.
You're listening to Serious Privacy by TrustArc. Please welcome our hosts, Paul Breitbarth and Kay Royal.
To create an account for a website, please choose a website between 6 and 24 characters consisting of an alphanumeric character, two special characters, one capital letter, the name of your pet, and your date of birth, or something along those lines. I think we have all encountered websites giving such instructions to create a new password. And while password managers can take away a lot of the irritation, the fact remains that every account should have a different password. In the business community, single sign-on has therefore quickly become very popular, allowing you to sign into an account once that can subsequently be used with many different services and applications. And for consumers, nowadays something similar exists. If you are willing to use your Google, Apple, or social media account as credentials for everything. But how do you know what would happen with your data when using those services? Can you trust those companies with your data? And would you like them to know where you log on? Our guests today are working on a solution they claim offers an anonymous but resistant authentication for safer online communities. HumanID is a nonprofit and open source project supported by Mozilla and Harvard University. And looking at their website, this may be a great example of privacy by design, but we'll let you be the judge of that at the end of today's episode. My name is Paul Breitbarth.
And I'm Kay Royal, and welcome to Serious Privacy. So, turns out all of us are not having the best days that we could possibly imagine, so I've decided the unexpected question is going to be something very simple. Paul will love this. Are you wearing socks?
No.
No.
Yes.
I knew Paul was going to have socks on. No, I was raised in Mississippi, spent most of my life barefoot. I still go barefoot when I can, but it's been a long time since I put high heels on. I'm not sure I could ever wear them comfortably again, frankly. Probably been a long time since any of y'all have put high heels on, too. So I'm sure you sympathize with me.
Yeah, the last time I wore high heels is a very long time ago. That is true. That was in a school play.
Same here, high school graduation.
All right, well, let's get started. I am eager to dive into this topic. We met y'all in another circumstance and was like, oh my gosh, this would be a fantastic podcast topic. And so just where did this come from? Usually I let Paul have the first question.
Well, let's just allow our guests to introduce themselves. Namik, can you give us a bit of background of who you are?
Definitely. My name is Namik. I go to business school at NYU. And I'm actually Turkish Azerbaijani, ethnically. So I've spent a lot of time in the US, but I have a very strong attachment as well as understanding of some of the regional issues, both geopolitically as well as culturally. And it's become a really, really fascinating topic. And it's part of the reason why I'm sitting here today working on HumanID.
And Bastian?
Yeah, I'm originally from Germany, as I'm sure you can guess from my accent, but I've spent the last 10 plus years working on early stage e-commerce companies in the US and in Asia, and usually doing digital marketing, which is basically meaning buying user data and then targeting you with creepy ads that follow you around the web or sending you newsletters.
All the things that I would not like.
Exactly. All the things that I learned to dislike strongly. And I think that goes a little bit into like where HumanID comes from. Like I've been part of that privacy part of the problem. And then when I lived and built a company in Indonesia, in Southeast Asia, vibrant democracy, starting 2015. And in that role, and when I lived there, I worked with one of the political parties there during their election seasons. And I sort of saw hands on how all the different parties use bot networks and fake accounts in massive numbers to spread news and oftentimes fake news, and how it disrupted credibility in the democracy and led to a very, very similar scenario to what I've seen 2 years later when I moved back to the States in the US, and we have all seen. And yeah, now I'm living in Los Angeles and just moved here 2 days ago. So,
oh, wow. Congrats.
Thank you.
It's a fascinating background.
So yeah, Paul and I have talked about elections before, so I can understand where that would be a little disconcerting.
Absolutely. So how did you end up with Human ID?
Yeah, so like I was living in Indonesia and I was sort of like brought these two things together, the privacy aspect that I'd known and like sort of as I know how data is sold. And on the other hand, this bot network problem and generally like I was thinking like what would it need for the web, for the internet to fulfill this mission we all had and like actually do democratization. And and there's a lot of studies that actually show that the fake news problem really comes from the bot problem. It's like massively driven by fake accounts that people set up to in a very focused way push these topics. It's not that suddenly people got better at lying. It's not, we have built a communication ecosystem and the way we debate things that really is made for liars and that emphasizes and gives them a much better way to spread disinformation and misinformation. And that leads to all these problems in the US, but also in democracies all around the world and in other countries around the world as well. And we're sort of going back, like it made me realize what we really need is what we have offline and what we have in elections, one identity that is like only one voice per person, but that voice being really safe and protected. And that's what Human ID is, so like one identity. And that is nonprofit, open source, so can be trusted. That is completely anonymizing users, but that really works on giving everyone only one voice. And that's what I started working on in Indonesia back then with technical co-founders. Siddiq was not on this call, but then I moved back to the States, built out the business part of the team. Namik joined the team as well. We went
Wow, you just find a problem and decide to solve it.
Just like that.
Someone has to, otherwise we have a big, big problem.
That is true. And when you say liars, I think the people behind the botnets absolutely are. But do you think the programmers who are programming this fascinating technology, who thinks it's just really cool and geeky, do you think they're deliberately trying to be false or a liar? Or do you think they're just really into the tech and it's the underlying people driving what they're developing?
So, I mean, you're basically talking about like the Facebook algorithm or the Twitter algorithms here, right? That emphasize polarization. And the problem here is like the incentive system. This graph, like Facebook engineers get paid if they manage, like based on how much they improve the revenue per user on the platform.
Right.
And Facebook as a whole makes money from selling users and views to advertisers. So in the first part, that really emphasizes engineers. And there's statistics that show that the more edgy and near to the line of what's illegal content is, the more likely it is to drive engagement. And that's clear where the problem comes. Like the engineers are paid to build algorithms that create polarization.
So they're not just geeking out. They know what the problem is.
I think on a top level, the company knows. But then that brings me to a second level. On a company level, like Facebook is not incentivized to optimize something else because their revenue per user would be lower. And also they are not incentivized to have this, like what the other part of Human ID, like the one per user. Because like studies show that 30 to 50% of Facebook users are fake. Facebook admits that they deleted 5 billion fake users last year, but like they should have deleted another billion. But the problem is Facebook doesn't have an incentive to be too strict, because if they would suddenly report 30% less users, they would have a massive, massive valuation problem on their hands.
They would. And here in the US, I mean, that example itself, they're facing actions for being essentially omnipotent, for having Instagram and WhatsApp and Facebook that no other social media can possibly compete with them. But you take me back to the talking about the fake accounts, whereas people with real accounts like me with my real name took me 4 months because they cut me off for a fake name account or whatever. And a social media company wanted me to send them my government ID over unprotected web to prove I was who I was. And I'm like, seriously? You're a social media company. No.
And I mean, it's important to know that this doesn't mean like everybody that ever has worked for Facebook is evil, right? There's been a lot of amazing things.
Exactly.
For sure.
Yeah. A lot of amazing things have come out of Facebook, like the Arab Springs. It's been a tool that has been used to utilize crowds, and that's great. What we're really talking about is, you know, the past 10 years or so, right? The past decade, we've seen a rise of these coordinated bot networks. We've seen a lot of incentive misalignment. And this is kind of where we're saying, hey, you know, social medias need to be thinking about identity. At the same time, there's a clear incentive problem. So maybe there should be a nonprofit framework like Human ID. Again, we're all open source.
Right.
That can come in and take this responsibility. It's the true responsibility of these social networks and help create a more equitable and real conversation.
Right. And you're so right, Namik. You're so right. It's not Facebook. It's not any one particular social media or account. It's everywhere. It really is. And none of us are trying to say it's just that's the best example to use because everybody knows
that's
Facebook.
That's true. So why is it important that it is open source? I stressed that in the opening. You've stressed it now. But why is it actually important?
I mean, simply put, we're not lying about anything. We're not hiding anything. We're not having any, like, for example, Zoom a month ago was like, oh, yeah, we have we have a different definition of encryption than everybody else. When it comes to stuff like data, it's very, very simple or easy to kind of have a misalignment of values. The reason we're open source is A, you know, anybody can look at our code. They can help us build. They can improve what we're working on. But also it's a trust level. It's fully transparent. Yeah. It's what we believe the internet should be. And we want to lead by example.
It's that user community.
Exactly.
Of experts, anyone that can feed into it. I love it.
I mean, just to add to like Namik's point, maybe one, I mean, open source has also been proven to be more secure, right? Like, and that is counterintuitive for many people, like non-technical people like me, but like there's studies and I've had these discussions with very senior engineers who say like, security through obscurity just doesn't work. Be open source and you will ultimately be more secure.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but there is that debate. I'm glad you brought that up because there is that debate where a lot of attorneys in particular don't like to see their companies using open source because they don't own it. So that depends on the licensing terms then that comes with the open source software and how well are they tracking it.
So can you tell us a bit more how would the Human ID technology work? If we compare it to the existing login with Google button, what would work differently here?
So from a user perspective, it's very similar. From a developer perspective, it's also very similar to integrate into your app or website. But what really is different is that we only look at the user's data to verify it. And as soon as it's verified, we create a unique hash from that user data, and then we delete the user data for good from our servers and only send an anonymized identifier to the platform you're logging into. No email, no phone number, no personal identifiable information whatsoever. And that identifier is also different for every different website the same user would log into, so that it's really an identifier that only has any use in that specific context of that website. And if it were to leak, and leaks are still going to happen, websites are still going to be hacked or accidentally leak data, that data is going to be pretty meaningless by itself and not going to be able to build profiles of users or to any way abuse that data.
Because the hash is unique every time and is irreversible.
Exactly. The hash is unique. We don't actually send the hash. We send an ID that's created from the hash. Because the hash is very long, but that's correct. The hash is different depending on user and servers, and therefore doesn't have any external use and is not reversible into the user data. And even we couldn't reverse it. I mean, at least with a bit of like normal computing power.
Yeah, we're not talking quantum computing yet.
Not yet. I think they're going to get there. But so tell me, so is this something, let's just put it in terms of TrustArc. So we have various types of users that might use our platform. We've got, of course, our internal employees who would log in as either support or they're building things, or we drink our own champagne and log in as users. or we're helping customers in it. We have customers with their employees who log in to log their company information. And then in some of our products, we actually have end users. They may not necessarily create accounts, but they do submit data such as individual rights manager. They would go to a web portal or they would go to a web form and fill that out based on what the company has asked them to provide. What's your relationship, your name, your location, whatever. Patient ID number, I don't know, whatever the company defines. So would this be usable in each of those three scenarios?
No, it's only usable in scenarios where you don't need to know who the other person is. Okay. So it's really about debate and speech. If okay. you have employees, you need to know which employee is which account, right? Like you have a legit reason to know that information. So there's no need okay. or added value from Human ID. Human ID is for online communities or platforms where the privacy of the user is really paramount and you don't have a legitimate reason to really know what physical, like which person is that exactly beyond the fact that it's a unique human being. To okay. speak up on social media, to put stuff into a whistleblowing app, for example, to like think about communities like mental health communities. These are like use cases where Human ID comes in, where really the platform, right now they're asking for the email or the phone number with the excuse of verification, authentication.
Right.
We're taking away that excuse and saying, hey, you don't actually have to have that information. It actually might be better for you not to have that information because then you don't have the risk of leaking it accidentally. You don't have all this like liability that comes along with GDPR and CCPA and so on. So
but you also can't target individuals or do behavioral.
That's correct.
Advertising.
Most companies don't actually do that and don't rely on that. Some do. We actually had some awkward conversations where like after 5 minutes into a call, we realized, oh, that company like survives based on selling user data. Maybe they don't like us, but that's not the kind of business we want to empower.
Right.
Most companies are not on that, are not there.
So it really is like if I wanted to be, and I tend to not be very political on any of my social media. I don't get into politics or religion. One, because it's not worth arguing with the other person. But two, I don't want it to reflect on me professionally. And regardless of how much I disclaim it, anything I do pretty much is going to reflect on my employer. So this would be a great use case for someone like me who wants to be able to engage in maybe some controversial topics. My view on abortion or anything along that line, but I want to be completely anonymous.
I couldn't agree stronger. There's so much self-censorship. It's massively self-censor myself on social media.
Yeah.
And we all do. And there should be a way. It's bad for democracy, right? Like it makes us worse at solving any topic. If it's climate change, if it's racism, if it's anything, if people don't feel like they're speaking up, the only way they're speaking up is going to be the ballot box. If they don't feel heard, because there they still have one protected identity.
And hopefully they're truly speaking up there and not been manipulated by the bots to stay home because the bots are telling them the lines are 3 miles long and it's 107 degrees outside.
Yes,
exactly.
Yeah. And they're listening to that rather than going to the poll and seeing for themselves that there's no one there in line.
And set a foot outside their door to see that it's actually raining.
Exactly. Well, you know, people don't get up and go look anymore. They don't. So what kind of uptick are you seeing? Are you seeing positive responses from companies about this technology?
Yeah, I mean, definitely. We've integrated with thousands of users, including, you know, whistleblowing apps or social medias. Now, at the same time, it's important to note, these are all change makers in the space. These are all people who say, hey, we're not a fan of the current climate. We don't like the fact that, you know, individual data is freely given to governments and sold to advertisers on the big social media platforms. We don't like that effectively any government can bully Twitter into doing whatever they want. So obviously these are change makers. These are where we're seeing the most reception. But we'd be super happy to also talk to established people as well. And we've been finding that's a bit harder. People say, hey, I make money off of this data. I don't really feel the need. I mean, some of them do, right? I don't really feel the need to change the status quo, and they kind of aren't looking at the reality, which
where
is
the
more and more
going.
People. Exactly. And more people care about privacy. You can very, very easily be disrupted if you don't focus on what your users really want. So we've definitely seen a lot of traction of up and coming companies who have the same visions as us And a bit less so with like the big guy.
Is that in the US or overseas more?
Both actually. We're integrated with whistleblowers in Japan, social medias in the US. And we primarily focus on the US at the moment because it makes more sense with at least scale, right? If we can get a big company that goes big in the US, it's going to be big everywhere.
Right.
And
I think the whistleblowing application is particularly fascinating because pretty much every company in the US that is subject to the SEC needs to have an anonymous whistleblowing line or process. And that usually involves hiring a very expensive third party to manage it for them.
Yeah, we actually in the...
And putting in very complicated rules.
In the process of integrating, I'm about to go live with one of the biggest whistleblowing apps in the US. So that's going to help us.
That'd be awesome.
Yeah, it's going to be great. I think we've been generally starting, like this, the sales cycle was a bit long because people do need to put us on their roadmap to get it live. And some of the companies we work with are pre-launch and then launch with us as like one of the differentiating features. And you'll see several social media apps go live this summer using Human ID. But yeah, we focus on the US but we are actually available in 26 languages. So we're trying to really, really be open for the world. And it works everywhere where SMS work, but China is probably just going to outlaw it. So, like, we are here to prevent the rest of the world to create into a similar ecosystem where every click can be linked back to the real person, and that person can be put into prison. That's the danger, and we are here to prevent that world. And in China, we are too late. So I've been becoming political now.
That's fine. We've done politics before on the podcast, so no worries there. Do you envisage that SSO, especially in the way that you are implementing it fully, privacy by design and by default, but that SSO in the longer run is capable to replace all those passwords that we're using? Or do we need something else for that?
I mean, definitely. In general, the answer in my eyes is definitely passwords are tough. I use password managers to know what's going on. There are clear...
Which ones do you like?
I'm using 1Password.
Okay. That's one I like too.
Because it's simple. Awesome. I'm glad I'm in good company.
Yes. Well, I don't know that I'd be considered good company, but that is one. You have to find it. You have to find a password keeper for people because... As Paul's heard me bemoan several times, the gentleman that created the control about changing your password every 90 days and needing upper characters and lower characters, the NIST control, he's apologized publicly to the world for doing that because it's not effective. But yet now it's embedded in our very DNA, and heaven forbid you don't change your password every 90 days. And now they're getting away from the couple of years ago, they were saying the best thing to do is to pick 4 random words. Mm-hmm. Not to pick a song, verse, or lyric or something that made sense, to pick 4 random words. They're no longer saying that's the best way either.
Well,
it's like, okay, password keeper, generate a random one.
I'm still of the school, as long as your password is very long, then it's very difficult to crack.
So about SSOs, there are some stuff which I don't think SSO is appropriate, right? There are bottlenecks, SIM swapping, things of this sort. And I totally understand that, but it's also a conversation of convenience. So it's really, really annoying if you have to go through like a 5-minute procedure just to log in. And that's part of why Human ID is structured and built out the way it is. We're trying to optimize for convenience while also keeping a truly private, anonymized identity.
Empowering people.
Exactly.
So I mean, that's what you're doing. You're empowering people.
Yeah.
Okay, that wasn't really a mic drop. Just saying.
We're speechless.
But that's what you're doing. You're empowering people to be able to speak up in a free society, which is the way democracy was intended to be, and not creating all this hate and angst that we're seeing that comes from online or news sources, as y'all say, with the bots and everything, that is driving so much division in the world. I mean, there's a lot of other things causing division, but let's be frank, that's part of it. And people are perfectly comfortable now online just completely destroying someone.
And, you know, the tough part is you don't know if it's a real person or a bot. That's like where it gets really, really sad. And we've seen this happen in a lot of countries in the global south where groups like Facebook, you know, they get a lot of trouble at least in the US, when their bot farms are openly exposed, right? In the global south, they couldn't care less. So there are use cases, there are examples where an activist group is talking about something, they release that information, a piece of news, and there are thousands of hateful comments on it, you know, saying you're betraying your country, all of these. You do a research, it turns out 96% of them are fake. They're all bot, they're all fake. And it doesn't matter if it's fake or not for the average user, because what they do is they walk through this message. They see, wow, everybody in my country really hates these guys. They must really not know what they're talking about. Right. They must be anti-government, like they must be American spies, who knows what, right? And before you know it, you're changing sentiment. Slowly, you're changing sentiment. And that's the reason I'm working on Human ID, right? Because if we don't have a community where we can speak our minds, even if we disagree, if we can't talk, if we can't agree, if I don't know if I'm talking to a real person, how are we going to fix climate change, right?
Oh, I agree. I've used an example that happened here in the U.S., and I don't remember what politician, and I don't remember exactly what. She was an elected official. She was running for re-election. It was on a local level. She had had a DUI something like 30 years before. And the example I use with my law students is, do you care? They're like, 30 years ago? No, we don't care. She was probably, you know, at the beginning of college and first out on her own. Well, you win 30, 50, 100,000 people start saying they hate her for this, and this means she's dishonest and she's tried to hide something. And what else is she hiding? And they actually hate her. Now do you hate her? If 50,000 people are talking about it, of course you do. Because even if they influence just one person each, that's 100,000. I mean, the onslaught to people is crazy. So I think your reasons for creating this are hugely valid. I, for one, hope it works. Not just because I want to be controversial and anonymous online, but I think it's something the world needs. I think you're right.
And that's where we need help, right? This is an uphill battle without a doubt. And, you know, anybody listening, if this sounds interesting to you, if this is a mission that you're willing to support in any way, please reach out.
Yeah.
We're always looking for allies, partners in any way, shape, or form. If you have a use case that you think would be phenomenal, again, please reach out. And
Oh, absolutely. We have a LinkedIn page. We can try to start start some conversation there about whether or not this topic is important to people. Do people see it, or do they need to hear this explanation of what it is before they understand the value of it?
So what kind of roles do you have in your team? I mean, I suggest I guess there will be some people with a technical background doing a lot of the programming. Some people doing the sales, but how do you work? Given that you're a nonprofit, is it all people working voluntarily, or do you also have proper jobs? Between parentheses, by now.
So we are fully volunteer driven. Everyone in the whole company is a volunteer, which has been really inspiring. I mean, having started with this idea, just seeing how many people care enough to take so much time out of their year really has been amazing. So we are, and that's partially also because we are definitely struggling on the fundraising side a little bit, because
you need grantors.
We need grantors and donors. The problem was we started in parallel with COVID, so the philanthropic world was pretty dried out. It's also unfortunately true that people sort of really focus on the short-term problems versus big solutions that really reframe the whole ecosystem. And so we've definitely been challenged on this side of fundraising. So anyone who has experience there is definitely welcome as well. Generally, I think open source engineers are the ones that could make the biggest impact, even just with reviewing code or with taking on a smaller feature. We are very, very open to have those conversations.
And we'll make sure that we include a link to you and your code in the podcast description. That way people can go, who are part of that community, can go and find it easily.
That would be amazing.
Oh, absolutely. Happy to do it.
I also want to add one more thing. Human ID is not going to, the goal isn't to create a nonprofit that will always rely on the grants of others and money, right? Human ID is a fully self-sustainable solution. And once we get off the ground in terms of funding, we want to constantly need people to keep donating and donating to keep us afloat. what we're really focusing on right now is, you know, putting those, I'm terrible with like American metaphors, but you know, like putting on those wheels to the, like their little like race car, right? And seeing what happens. And that jet fuel is, that's the stage we're at right now. And we're seeing a lot of traction.
Oh, good. And yeah, so by the way, I throw out metaphors and mix them all up horribly. So you're okay.
No, but it is fascinating, especially the stage where you are in, where you can also show the real life, the first real life examples, how it works. And I think that is also a good trigger for other people to get involved. And I'm amazed you've been able to pull this off with volunteers only, to be honest.
Yeah. Do you have any of your customers listed on your website yet, or all of them are still kind of... You do. Okay, beautiful. Can you name some of your customers?
So one of
Would
our...
it be anyone we'd recognize?
Not yet. Those are still in integration, but those will happen. But and the ones that we have, you probably won't recognize, as a Germany-based social media company called Polarizer that specifically wants to encourage polarizing conversation, which in these days is a very brave encounter.
Interesting.
Also fully open source.
Good timing with the German elections coming up.
That is true. I'm actually waiting for my letter right now.
For your ballot.
And of course, following the misinformation in the race closely as well. I have to say multi-party systems are better equipped to handle it generally, but that's a different conversation maybe another time.
It's anonymous, right?
Elections are, we believe this, the public debate should work like an election. One voice per person, but fully protected if people want to be anonymous. And that's a really, really important benchmark. And right now the web is the exact opposite. Nobody's anonymous and everyone can be a million voices if they have the money to buy those million voices.
And I'm probably the only one on the phone here that remembers when there wasn't an internet.
No, I do remember.
I remember that.
Oh, y'all are like vaguely back when you were kids.
Oh, no.
I'm older than you.
Oh, no. It was actually very exciting when we got connected to the internet.
Yes.
I actively remember that, and with a modem that needs to dial up and with all the sounds.
All that like, funky noise.
Yes.
And yeah.
I vividly recall all of that. So
I waited 45 minutes for websites to load.
Exactly. Yes.
Oh, that's awesome. Because my husband and I recorded a podcast episode that we hadn't published yet. But in there, we talk about the differences between our families because his family was quite affluent and mine was not in the different regions of the U.S. we were in. He definitely had computers and internet long before I did. Long before. So.
Yeah, my parents just didn't believe the internet would be a thing. That's more of...
Oh, wow. Remember when people actually called it the World Wide Web and the highway, the super information highway?
The internet, yeah.
We all remember the time when people believe it solved all the problem.
True.
And make the world a better place. That's not that long ago.
And it did for a while, though.
Well, that's still a possibility.
Wow, that caused reactions.
There is still a possibility that the internet will solve some problems for us, at least, but we need maybe a bit of a reset.
There is a little bit of a problem that it hasn't quite solved yet. Your grandmother still wanting to call you up because you know something about computers and being online and helping her fix her computer.
Have you tried switching it off and turning it back on again? Solution number one. No, but what I wanted to say is I'm really impressed by all the work that you've done coming up with a first world problem that needs to be fixed anywhere in the world and finding ways to get that done with volunteers only. So
staying on top of the privacy laws.
Big congratulations for that. Thank you for reaching out to us, because also for us, this is an eye opener and we're happy to do our little bit of endorsement this way for the project and give you some more attention. So thanks very much.
Definitely
for joining us.
Epitome of privacy enhancing technology.
Thank you.
So Namik Basyan, when we invited you and when you reached out to discuss the project in the first place, was there anything that you wanted to make sure you told us and you told our audience that we haven't discussed yet?
And we talked a lot about the big world problems, but I think what's important for maybe some of your audience is we really solve problems for individual companies as well. Like conversion rates can be increased if there's a privacy friendly solution, engagement can go up, and the problem that you folks know more about, we solve a lot of these litigation problems around GDPR and CCPA. If you don't have any personal identifiable information, then you are not in danger of accidentally leaking it. So it's much easier to follow those rules. And so we do really also help companies make more money or like give a better user experience with our product.
Also, depending on the company, there's also massive savings in content moderation, right? So you're seeing so many of these phenomenal like dialogues, newspapers, things of this sort, even YouTube, some of the chats having to shut down. Part of that is because, you know, people are saying terrible things, but it's also because, I mean, the real thing is just massive bot network attacks, right? Just saying, oh, this is an opinion and we're going to push this opinion and cost us absolutely nothing to do so. That's a big one. Another one is truth. So people are, depending on the use case, right, people are going to be more honest when they're anonymous. So for a polling app, no one's going to, if they know your name, everything about you, and they do and are going to sell your individual data, you're not going to tell them what you think. And this is just a fact. Mental health as well, right? There's so many questions around telehealth. If it's a taboo, how am I supposed to feel really comfortable sharing this with my own doctor, let alone some stranger over the internet who is probably going to get hacked or has like someone outsourcing their privacy stuff, and who knows who that is? They might be listening in on my conversations. There was a scandal last year or something where Apple was outsourcing some like privacy-related stuff. I think it was with Siri, I don't remember, to a contractor, and the contractor would hear personal information about what individuals were doing. So there's a lot of these kinds of questions. Humanities solves more or less most of them. And obviously we're not the only, we're not saying we are the singular solution. We think we're a piece of the pie. We're part of the puzzle. We just want to be the identity integration aspect of it. And even if you don't want it to be us, all our code is open source. You know, let's make something happen. We'd be more than happy. Yeah.
That sounds great. Well, thank you, Bastian. Thank you, Namik, for joining us today. And thanks to all our listeners for joining us again for this episode of Serious Privacy. If you like our series, please do tell your friends and colleagues about us and rate and review our episodes in your favorite app or on your favorite platform. You can do so anonymously, I think, on some platforms. Should you have any questions or suggestions, please reach out to us via seriousprivacy@trustark.com or via Twitter @podcastprivacy. You'll find us on LinkedIn, just look for Serious Privacy, and you will find Kay on Twitter as Heart of Privacy and myself as Europol B. Until next week, goodbye.
Bye, y'all.
That was Serious Privacy.
Hey listeners, looking to navigate the realm of responsible AI data privacy governance? Well, look no further.
Absolutely. TrustArc is paving the way, offering a complete approach to managing privacy risks in the world of AI.
TrustArc allows organizations to confidently use AI with personal or sensitive data, moving forward efficiently and cost-effectively.
And here's the kicker. Protect your company and data with TrustArc's privacy-driven compliance software.
Because they're deep automation streamlines data privacy governance, cutting your time to compliance with automated data mapping, risk assessments, and regulatory reporting.
TrustArc's enhancements go way beyond that, helping organizations understand AI better and align cross-functionally on data governance, privacy, and security.
Plus, they provide guidance on privacy governance for AI and how to mitigate risks using frameworks like NIST AI, OECD AI, and the NIMACY Privacy Management Accountability Framework.
If you're aiming for compliance excellence, check out Privacy Central, seriously one of my best parts. It uses automation and privacy expertise to understand your requirements, build and manage your privacy program with ease.
Oh, I agree. Privacy Central is your go-to to measure your progress toward responsible AI data compliance.
Stay ahead with TrustArc's Privacy Central. Visit TrustArc.com now. Ask me and Paul if you have any questions.